I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the Egyptian army chief has a warning for his nation. France urges international support for the Syrian opposition. A look at the role of women in the Kurdish struggle. And doctors assess the consciousness of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon.
At some level, he is conscious. And this is very important for the family.
It's all ahead. A strong warning from the head of Egypt's military. The country's political crisis could lead to the collapse of the state. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who also serves as defense minister, made the comments in a speech to military academy cadets. This follows a night of protests with hundreds of anti-government demonstrators defying state of emergency rules and a nighttime curfew. VOA's Paul Westphalen gets details from our Cairo correspondent Elizabeth Arrett.
What they did was to actually organize rallies right before the curfew was to go into effect. In some of the cities under this curfew, actually, they arranged for football games, but mainly mass rallies on the streets to show that they were going to defy any kind of order from the president. These obviously are very angry young people mainly, and they have been out in force for days now, much of it anti-Morsi, but also anti-police. We also had a ruling that has given temporarily the army the right to arrest people involved in this. It's unclear now exactly how strong the army is going to be, but we did have a statement Tuesday morning from the army chief saying that if this violence continues, it risks a collapse of the state.
That's kind of curious because the military, as I recall, when Mubarak was in power, also worried about the collapse of the state, which led to Mubarak leaving and a new government being ushered in.
I think one of the main things is trying to find some stability at this point, and that was a risk with the protests under Mubarak. What the problem is now, there doesn't seem to be much of an alternative, and some of the underlying currents of the discontent is 2 years after the revolution, people really haven't seen any great changes. And one of the things that would really help is to have economic conditions improve. Now, putting all of these three cities that are the sort of flashpoint cities are along the Suez Canal, obviously a huge money earner for Egypt. And so they don't want to risk any chance of that, of something happening there that would interrupt that flow of revenue or scare away investors even farther or continue the unrest keeping tourists away. It's in everybody's interest, they believe, to calm things down. On top of that, of course, there has been this staggering loss of life. Dozens of people have been killed in a very short period of time. So all around, I think they just want to try and calm things down.
It's kind of difficult to lure tourists to Egypt and to lure investment to Egypt when you've got this kind of violence continuing, when you've got people out in the street. What are you hearing from the opposition about their desire to bring stability back to the country?
Well, I think from the opposition political leaders, there is growing frustration about them. These are people, the National Salvation Front, we have Nobel Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei, and other sort of senior figures. People are increasingly calling them out of touch. They, from the get-go on this, said that they would not negotiate with the government without these preconditions. One analyst I was just speaking with this morning said, you know, what you want somebody to negotiate. This is a point where we have to negotiate. And by their refusing to, it only seems to polarize the situation and create the stalemate where nothing is going forward. So there is frustration all around.
When you talk about the opposition, what kind of numbers are we talking about? Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands? What is the estimate that you've heard?
It's very difficult to say, and it still, again, needs to be broken down. You know, people who don't take to the streets but are unhappy with the Brotherhood, you know, is probably a sizable minority. Then you get down to the smaller groups of people who actually come out on the streets and protest and peaceful demonstrations, a smaller group yet, and then a very small group of angry young men, and we have seen them in videos are actually taking up arms at this point against police. That is a very small fraction, but of course is gaining a lot of the attention.
Sounds to me like a largely peaceful anti-government demonstration stirred up by a small group of people. Is that fair?
that small group of people can cause a lot of damage and create a cycle of violence in which then the police respond, where more people get hurt, and then that brings more people out in the street in general protest.
Correspondent Elizabeth Errett speaking with us from Cairo. At the White House, spokesman Jay Carney reacted to the unrest gripping Egypt.
We strongly condemn the recent violence that has taken place in various Egyptian cities. We extend our condolences to the families of those who were killed and to those who were injured. We look to all Egyptians to express themselves peacefully and for all Egyptian leaders to make clear that violence is not acceptable. We welcome serious calls for national dialogue to avoid further violence and to find peaceful means to move forward with the political process and building national unity. Egyptians participated in their revolution to bring about democracy and freedom, not to pursue their goals through violence. We urge all Egyptians to peacefully utilize the democratic process as they continue to engage with their government. We have been clear about what we stand for. We have engaged directly with the Egyptian government as they move forward on the difficult path towards greater democracy and rule of law, and we will continue to do so.
White House spokesman Jay Carney. Amnesty International says its researchers have documented unnecessary lethal force by security forces in Egypt over the past several days. The organization interviewed eyewitnesses to the clashes between demonstrators and authorities. We spoke about the findings with Amnesty campaigner Nicholas Piachau.
Particularly in Suez, where our researcher was recently, what happened was that the researcher went to Suez and spoke to people there who told us that after a large march on Suez's security directorate, the police there began to fire tear gas. But then the violence escalated after one of the security forces was seriously injured. And protesters told us that at that point, the riot police panicked and they started to fire indiscriminately. And they also chased fleeing protesters, which led to the deaths, we believe, of around 8 people, according to medical sources.
In a situation like this, there's a lot of tension. There's bound to sometimes be some violence, but you want them to rein it in a bit.
Absolutely. What we are seeing is very clearly that there has been violence, there has been protester violence, and it has been targeted against the security forces and, in some cases, government installations. At the same time, international law is very clear that violence by protesters does not give security forces a blank check to do whatever they want. They can't shoot and beat protesters randomly. The use of force has to be in proportion to the threat that they're facing, and it has to be based on a very clear assessment of what they're facing. And there has to be a very clear chain of command before force is used as well.
Are you calling for an international investigation of this?
We're calling, I think, primarily for Egypt itself to investigate what is happening. And I think what I can say is that for many years, the security forces in Egypt have operated with almost total impunity for human rights violations, including unnecessary and excessive force used against protesters. Very few members of the security forces have ever been brought to book or successfully prosecuted for protester violence. And that's the context in which the violations are happening right now. What we're calling for is for Egypt to independently and impartially investigate these abuses and bring the perpetrators to justice.
What is your reaction to President Morsi announcing a month-long state of emergency and imposing that curfew in the province of Suez and other places?
I think what we would call for is for the authorities to consider whether less intrusive measures would be better suited to restore order. Under the 30-year state of emergency, under Hosni Mubarak, the security forces again operated with impunity and committed horrific human rights violations. I don't think the answer now is that a new state of emergency is ideal. I think what we would call for is for the authorities to take, measures short of a state of emergency and to ensure that the security forces uphold human rights in their policing, including that they don't arbitrarily arrest and detain people, which has happened under previous states of emergency.
Nicholas Piachau, a campaigner on the Egypt team at Amnesty International in London. France urged Western and Arab nations meeting in Paris on Monday to make good on pledges to support Syria's opposition, warning that failure to do so would play into the hands of Islamist extremists. Lisa Bryant has more on talks that also included senior members of the Syrian National Coalition.
After pledging millions of dollars in aid and other assistance to the opposition Syrian National Coalition, France says the international community must now deliver. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius issued that blunt message as he opened a meeting of the two groups in Paris.
Responsabilité à tous. Nous sommes plus de 50 pays.
Fabius said representatives of the 50 countries meeting in the French capital had the responsibility to strongly support the opposition coalition. Otherwise, he warned, they risk extremist fighters in Syria gaining ground. He said the international community cannot allow a peaceful uprising to degenerate into a clash among militia groups. Since its formation in November, the Syrian opposition coalition has gained the backing of more than 100 countries, but not all have followed up on assistance pledged at a meeting in Marrakesh last month.
La coalition nationale syrienne a vocation à acheminer l'aide.
Besides representing the Syrian people, the coalition, Fabius said, is also critical to delivering humanitarian aid. Concerns about the growing cloud of Islamists in Syria were underscored Monday when an al-Qaeda-linked group, Jabhat al-Nusra, took responsibility for a suicide bombing committed the week before. But foreign governments have been slow to assist the moderate Syrian coalition because it is perceived to lack cohesion. The coalition vice president, Riyad Saif, said time is short. He says funding is needed to set up an interim government and to protect so-called liberated zones held by the rebels. Syria's 22-month uprising has killed more than 60,000 people and uprooted millions of others. Still others have disappeared, and many Syrians urgently need humanitarian assistance. In Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told reporters that Russia, once perceived as a staunch ally of the Syrian regime, does not support the Assad government or any other party in the conflict. His comments came a day after Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said Assad made a potentially fatal error by delaying democratic reforms demanded by Syria's opposition. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
United Nations humanitarian officials are making an appeal for international aid as those affected by nearly 2 years of fighting struggle for basic services. John Ging, who is director of operations for the UN Humanitarian Agency, told reporters in New York Monday that an estimated 4 million people are in need of assistance, particularly for medical supplies and food aid.
The situation in Syria, as we all know, continues to deteriorate, and that means that there are greater needs, more people in need, but also that the needs are more acute as the coping mechanisms continue to collapse.
He led a UN team to Syria and Lebanon last week and said the living conditions for people across Syria are quite appalling. He also described the shocking scale of devastation to the nation's infrastructure.
We saw what you would expect. We saw the effects of 22 months of conflict. We saw a population that are very weary. And quite despairing. The infrastructure is significantly damaged. Both sides are targeting infrastructure.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is set to lead a humanitarian pledging conference Wednesday in Kuwait with a goal of raising $1.5 billion to help civilians impacted by the fighting. Killing earlier this month of three female Kurdish activists in Paris highlighted the powerful role women play, both politically and militarily, in the Kurdish struggle. Dorian Jones has this report from Istanbul.
Özlem Özen is attending a local women's group meeting. As a senior member of the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, or BDP, in Turkey, she says gender equality is at the heart of the movement.
Ya bizim için çok önemli çünkü yani sonuçta verilen bir kadın mücadelesi var. Bu
Our party is attractive to women as it's the only political party that gives importance to women's freedoms and equality and for them to participate in the democratic process, she says. We have a quota of a minimum of 40% positions for women as candidates and positions in the party. You will find women at every level of our movement. Among the three women killed in Paris early this month was Sakine Cansız. She is one of the most visible symbols of women within the military and political ranks of the Kurdish movement. Shortly after she was gunned down, photographs circulated showing her in her khaki military uniform standing alongside Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the rebel Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. Sociologist Nukat Sirman of Istanbul's Bostrus University has been studying Turkey's Kurdish minority. She says women have become a formidable force within the country's pro-Kurdish movement.
They're both within the party organization, but they're also autonomous from it. They have their own organization. They have their own decision-making bodies, and they can actually, they are the ones who decide who is going to stand for election, who is going to be within the list for an MP candidate. They try to make women's rights a central part of the party's policies. And the party has accepted that, and they have that place within the party organization. In that sense, they're very, very powerful.
Nearly a third of the 35 parliamentary deputies of the BDP are women. That's more than double the 14% representation of women in Turkey's parliament. According to experts, women are also believed to make up more than a quarter of the ranks of the PKK armed rebel group. And PKK founder Öcalan, now in a Turkish prison, has stressed the importance of fighting for women's equality along with Kurdish rights in many of his writings. That message has influenced attitudes within the country's Kurdish movement. Sociologist Nukat Sirman explains.
Equal presence of women in all areas of Kurdish opposition has really revolutionized both the party and the conditions of life in these regions. For example, any member of the municipality who is found to have used violence against a woman in their household is fined. Women's organizations that provide support for victims of violence against women, etc., they have the power to go into these homes.
For Kurdish activist Ozem, there is still much work to do in changing men's attitudes towards women, even within her party.
Kadın çalışmalarını önemsiyor, pozitif ayrımcılığı önemsiyor. Bunu hem yönetim kademelerinde, kendi belediyedeki yönetim kademelerinde, hem de toplumsal çalışmalarında.
Women have shown their force and their power in politics, in the field of social services and the wider struggle, she says. When we have a chance, we have shown what we can do. The biggest step in changing attitudes. Our motto is, more women take part in the democratic process, so democracy gets stronger. And let's say, with the struggle for gender rights entwined with that of the Kurdish minority rights, women are likely to continue to increase their representation and profile within the pro-Kurdish movement. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
7 years after a stroke left him in a vegetative state, former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is said to be able to process information and exhibits what doctors call robust activity in his brain. Here, the first to speak is Dr. Ilan Shelef, followed by Dr. Alon Friedman.
We didn't expect to see any response after such a long time of partially vegetative state. And it was very emotional situation to see it's actually online, to see the response in the brain.
We know that he can process pictures and pictures of faces, and he can even differentiate it between, for example, picture of faces and pictures of houses, pictures of his families to other objects. He can, for example, differentiate between words that were spoken to him by his son compared to noise. We cannot project anything. The point is that for his family and for the treating team, we now know that he can take information and process it, and even perhaps at some level he is conscious. And this is very important for the family.
However, the doctors say the chances of Mr. Sharon regaining full capabilities are almost zero. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.